Would you ask Pop that question?
Let's do it.
Welcome to the Athletic NBA Show.
Monday through
on the Athletic Podcast Network.
In honor of Black History Month.
Black History Month.
Any coach that's had James Worthy was fortunate.
Because he played hard.
My gosh, James played unselfishly. Believe what a competitor he is. I think Chick Hearn described that by saying big game James, but I'm a little disappointed our Carolina people didn't think of that first.
No, Jerry's the greatest judge of talent in America, I think. And when he said James will be the number one pick, wow. Rod, what are you laughing about? You called me about Michael, didn't you, for the third round?
Big game James, come on up.
To reach this evening, to be inducted into the Hall of Fame, you have to have some skills as a basketball player. More importantly, it's the people along the way that nurture you. It's the people that were in their lives that made them what they are. After my high school days, I went to the University of North Carolina because of one reason, Coach Dean Smith.
Coach Dean Smith.
He really enhanced what my parents had started for me as a young man. When you're recognized as being, you know, the best in your hometown or your city, sometimes you start to expect things.
He came to my house.
He shook my hand for a second, and that was the only
interaction that I had for him.
He had a conversation with my parents because he wanted to know the player's parents, how they were raising their kids. So when they were away from home and were with him, not only did he have his philosophy, but he took a little bit of your parents, and he nurtured that. And I can remember him coming in and, you know, you're expecting to know how many sneakers you're going to get, how many minutes you're going to play. He calmly said, James, you come to North Carolina, and I promise you that you're going to go to class. Said, unless you get a written permission from your parents, you're going to go to church your freshman year. And everyone was treated the same.
Everyone. There was no double standing there.
Coach Smith, I'd like to thank you. My two older brothers are here, and I got to tell you, I hated them for a long time.
I was their human baby doll. Whenever they needed something, I was the guy.
They were my first coaches. My first babysitters. They hated me hanging around.
They were my first coaches.
Look where you got me. I thank my teammates, both at the University of North Carolina. Of course, a lot of people say Michael Jordan was the man, but I kind of taught Michael everything he knew.
I didn't teach him anything I knew. Kareem, thank you for taking me under your wing early in my career. Teach me a little bit about jazz and history on the back of the bus. Bob McAdoo.
Watched you from your North Carolina days, and he's a former North Carolinian, and I'd like to thank you for, you know what, everything. Dad, we spent a lot of time with our mom, and it took a long time for me to understand the sacrifices that you made. 3-4 jobs. Not always able to attend my games. It took me a long time to understand the love that you gave to our family. I'd just like to thank you. That's all I have to say. It's an overwhelming.
In honor of Black History Month.
Black History Month.
Do me a favor. When you're looking back, because I might use some of this for video. The camera... Above yeah, because you're looking
over here.
Yeah, you're looking to the side. What are you looking at, actually?
Well, that's the
It's horizontal.
Yeah,
it's like my camera.
I got it.
The camera's here, so I got to look there when I'm talking to you.
Right.
Am I looking at it now when I talk?
Yeah,
you are.
Yeah,
you don't have to do it the whole time.
Yeah, it's hard, but I know I'll start talking to David here.
All right.
I'll go back to my TV days and focus on.
The green dot, baby.
When I first went to Turner, it's so funny. I remember this. I think I told you this, Jay. So Tim Colley, the first time I'm on set on Inside.
Yeah.
He says, if you look at that f-ing camera after Ernie asks you a question, I'm going to break your f-ing arm.
He had to break me
of that ESPN habit, right?
They told me the same thing because when I did some work with ESPN, they go, all right, I'll be fine.
Right.
You get the turn and go, don't worry about the camera. We'll find you.
Right. I was like, okay, I got you.
Yeah. All right. Yeah, that was the hard thing with it because ESPN.
Look at the camera.
Look at the camera.
you guys recording? D.A. Marcus?
Yes, sir. I am recording.
Yep.
All right.
Here we go. 3, 2.
Let's bring D.A. into the conversation here.
Welcome to Who
Comma Is
Adjacent on the Athletic Podcast Network.
I turned it on and I heard Shaq with the barbs. It's like the most in his bracket. No, I was transported right back into it. I was like, oh, this is great.
I think I rap better than Shaq.
With David Aldridge.
Oh, he's totally playing. Yes. And then he got their lungs out in front of everybody on TV.
Michael was not your friend.
It was popping in there.
And Marcus Thompson.
I just can't get with this idea of taking 1 hour of content and finding the morsel that might pop and blowing at him.
Hoops adjacent.
Welcome to Hoop
5, 4. We have ignition.
And it is another edition of Hoops adjacent.
The comma is
David Aldridge.
What's up, sir? How are you on this wonderful debut of the 2022 Black History Month?
And it's another Hoops Adjacent episode of the Athletic NBA Show. David Aldridge here in D.C. in the Bay. Marcus Thompson, what is up, sir? What's the blockbuster trade the Warriors are going to make? Who are they trading Klay Thompson for?
Klay Thompson, forget that. It's Steph, Klay, Draymond, and Andrew Wiggins for Brandon Ingram.
There you go. That's a...
And some Zatarans.
Exactly. So it's so good that we have our guest this week. Billy King, former GM of the Philadelphia 76ers, the Brooklyn Nets. Billy, give the folks your working title now. What's your working title?
I guess coach, WIP, contributor, NBA TV, just dad.
Man about town.
I got a funny Billy King story. I was first getting on the beat, and I don't know if you just got hired or you already had the job, but you know, I grew up in Oakland. So I was like, the A's announcer is the GM of the of the 76ers? What?
How'd that happen?
Bill King, what? What's happening? I'm sorry, I was young. I didn't know any better.
Well, I'll give you an even funnier story. When I was in high school, my insurance agent, was named Bill King.
Is that right?
Oh, nice. And David, you dealt with Bill King in Milwaukee. He was the
Bill
PR
King too. We used to call him. Yeah, Bill King too. Because he would sign everything Bill King the second, you know, so we just called him Bill King too. Yeah. So the first time I met Billy King, I think you may not remember this. The first time I met Billy King is because he made Mark Macon cry. That was the first time I met Billy King. It was the East Regional Final when Billy King locked up Mark Macon at Temple. What was he, 7-29 that day, Billy?
I think 6-28, something like that.
Something like that. Made him cry.
Don't be talking about you think. You know exactly what he was.
Like 6 or 7 air balls, something like that.
Right.
But you know, ironically, that was my job. I couldn't score, so my job was to guard the guy that could score, and so that's what I did. And ironically, now I've lived here in Philadelphia for over 24 years now, and people to this day come up and say, "You ruined my senior year." You know?
Marcus, I covered Temple the whole time in the tournament. Their whole run to the East Regional Final, I was like, "Yeah, I'm going to the Final Four with Temple. This is going to be great." And it got shut down in the East Regional Final, Billy King crushed my dreams.
And then Duke ruined your day. Done it quite a few times.
I had gotten Chaney to kind of warm up a little bit. Oh, it's good. I was like, this is going to be fun. But great career in college. And you have been a longtime NBA executive, Billy. That's why we wanted to have you here. This is trade week. We're taping this on Tuesday. We've had two blockbuster deals already on Tuesday. Maybe have some more by the time this actually drops on Wednesday. So, man, just give me your thoughts. I mean, I like the deal, the McCollum deal, obviously for New Orleans.
Yeah.
I really like the Indiana deal for Indiana for Sabonis. I mean, I think getting one of Hield or Halliburton would have been fine. Getting both is wild to me.
It's an assault is what it is. Unbelievable. It's larceny. Wow. Don't get me started. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Well, I look at both of them, and I think New Orleans, they got a veteran player who's a great guy to come in that locker room and sort of try to help those young guys how to learn how to win. I think when Griff made the trade to move Jrue Holiday, he got these extra picks, and this was what it was for, to bring in players like this. Zion, Ingram, they need a guy like a CJ who can sort of be a mentor. And when young guys come in the league, if they don't have veteran guys that tell them this is what it takes to win, when the coach calls out practice and you've had four games of five nights, and, you know, this young guy and the players are revolting, you need a veteran to say, hey, we need this. Let's go to work. It's not going to be long. Get in there and do it. That's what those guys need. So I think it's a great deal for New Orleans. And, you know, Portland, I just think they're in a phase where they've had this team together, and they keep trying to put pieces around Lillard and McCollum, and it hasn't worked. And now they've kept Lillard, and they're going to try to build around Damon Lillard. And they've got cap space, they've got picks, and they're going to say, Damon, look, we have the ability now to go build a team around you. It wasn't working with you and CJ, and this is what we're going to do. As a GM, sometimes you make those deals, and people are killing you, saying, I can't believe they gave him away. And sometimes you don't know what's behind the curtain when you make those deals. The direction you get from ownership, and they may say they want to go a certain way, clean up the books, let's give it some payroll. And as a GM, you execute it, and then you walk out like it was your deal. And you, because at the end of the day, I always said to my coach, my owner, I said, whatever we argue behind the closed doors, we go out there and make a deal, it's going to be us. We did this. It wasn't the coach won this or the ownership. This is what we did. And so I think for them, it's great. For Indiana, I think it's an amazing deal. Sabonis, I liked him. But that team wasn't going anywhere once again. And I think they got a young player in Haliburton. I think you're going to see them do a lot more to try to get younger and build and be athletic, cut their payroll down and just start building over. In this league right now, you have the top teams that are trying to find that next piece to get them over the hump, as did Milwaukee did with Jrue Holiday. So they're looking for the big home runs, a big deal to get in there. The bottom teams are trying to get into the playoffs, get those pieces that they can, in 3 years, they could be one of those top teams.
Yeah.
You know, what's so interesting, this is one of what you do and did is one of the kind of like untapped parts. We know about everything in sports except what you're doing in that room, right? Like, there's a lot of that we don't know. I'm curious, when trade season was coming, like I'm sure it's like a man with an old knee, right? He could feel it coming, like, oh, the rain is coming. I can feel it. I'm sure you got that kind of second sense. How did you prepare mentally for what is got to be an incredibly busy and stressful time? Like, what did you do to get ready for it?
Well, a lot of it's work you've done starting in October, or maybe in the summertime, where you kept notes on different teams you called. Team A would give up this, Team B would give up that. And so as you're talking, you start trying to pressure people. The main deal you want, you start trying to pressure. And for me, I would always make sure I had all my notes, had, you know, my cap stuff, had the rules, and had my staff ready to go, knew what picks we had, knew what everybody else's picks they had. And so when you're talking to them, you can say, I know you have a pick in 2024, you know, protected. We'll take that one. Or I said, no, you can't trade a pick because you've got some that are outstanding. But you want to have all your ducks in a row, because what throws you off is when somebody calls out of the blue and say, would you do X, Y, and Z? And now you've got to get your team together and, all right, run the numbers, see what that looks like. Does it work? Okay, we don't want to give up this player. See if we can go back. And David always jokes about me because I was always loved on 3 and 4 team deals. And how I would go about it is I would know what Team A would want, Team B would want, Team C and D. And I said, well, they need a small forward. I can get a small forward from Team A. So let me see if they'll take this small forward. And they go, yeah, okay, they got that. So now Team C needed a power, a big. Well, I can get a big from Team B. And you start putting together, and you put the numbers on paper and say it works. And then you got to go back to them and say, okay, if I get you this, and they say, yeah, they want to know the name. And I said, once I give you the name, then you're going to know. So you try to put it together like that. But you've got to make sure that you have everything lined up. And because it goes quickly, as you get close to 3 o'clock, and now it's even tougher with the league because you got to have so much into them. Before, when I first started back in 97, you can call and say, you know, this is Billy King, Philadelphia. I'm doing a deal with Boston. Here are the parameters. You know, it's these two players or these two players and a second round pick in this year. And they say, okay, and they'll go look it all up, make sure it all works. So they come back and say, we're going to do a call in 2 hours. Okay. Now you've got to make sure if the player's on the insurance, you got to have that to them. You got to have all the physical records to them. You've got to have, you know, the salaries, everything's got to be sent in so they can look at it. Because I think what they found, people were giving them deals that weren't working, or and there have been times back in the day where I'd be on a call and we're trying to find if a guy had life insurance, and the GM's like, I think he does. I got to find our CFO. And, you know, it's 6 p.m. and he's calling and he goes, he's got to come back to the office. So, all right, we'll reconvene in 3 hours to try to get this deal done. So, so they want to, they try to avoid all that now.
You did a lot of deadline deals, and there's teams that don't. I mean, San Antonio's notorious for just not. Yeah. They just don't do it. If they do something and it's rare in season, they do it early and get it out of the way. I just wonder, like, how difficult was it? Because you had, in Philly, you had a coach in Larry Brown who just wanted to change the team all the time. And in Brooklyn, you had an owner who wanted to change the team all the time. So how did you kind of you deal with that? With those pressures of people that you know you have to work with, and tell them, look, we could do this, but we can't do that. You know, we're just not going to be able to do that. But they're insistent on doing these big kind of splashy deals.
Well, a lot of that, like with Larry, for example, he would come to my office starting season started in November games. Starting in the November, he'd be in my office every morning before
after the second game,
after practice,
and trade everybody.
Just try to do this, you know. And some things I would work on. Some that I call them, they don't want to do that deal, even though I didn't call them. I would just put them off. And then the day that after the trade deadline, I'd have to go find him. He wouldn't come to my office because then he's ready to coach. So I would try to look at it and it's from a standpoint, and I'd argue back with stuff and say, if we do this, it's going to affect us down the road. We can't do this, or if we do this, it's going to affect this guy's minutes, or I find out backgrounds that Larry, this guy won't be able to play for you. With Moscow and Burkhoff and his group, you know, there would be a lot they'd want to do. And sometimes I said, that's not doable, or I know they won't make that deal. So it was a lot of phone calls and texts and a lot of the time and energy spent on talking them down a little bit. And so in the GM role, you've got to manage up and you got to manage down. And that's where a lot of my time was spent. My staff would be working on things that I knew we could get done. And then I'd spend a lot of my time managing up and down.
So you got, three kids, right?
Yes. Yeah.
So I feel for them, right? I feel for their ability to be, you know, kids growing up trying to manipulate their parents, because you have to be a master at detecting somebody lying to you, right? I mean, how much lying happens this time? Like, and how do you know when somebody's trying to fleece you?
Well, you know, when they call, and I'm sure some people on the Zoom goes, well, he got fleeced a lot of times. When they call, you know, like, you know, when I was in Philly beginning, we always talked on the phone. You know, Jerry West would call me, you know, Wes Unseld. They would call. When I got back in with Brooklyn, I'd get these texts. Would you do this? Who's this? You know, and then I was like, oh, this is how we do it now. We just text it. And a lot of times I don't like to text because you don't want to put it in writing, because they can go back and say, wait a minute, you said 2 months ago you do this. So so invariably I would pick up the phone, but there is a lot of lying. And you sort of know which people you're dealing with that are, okay, this is sincere. Or you start thinking, okay, why do they want this deal? There were people who call me when I was in Brooklyn and they say, yeah, would you trade Joe Johnson? And I know they're trying to work on a bigger deal. I said, okay, they need Joe Johnson number to try to go get a bigger deal. So, you know, so I wouldn't do it. Or I would say, well, I would do it, but you got to give me those two first round picks also. Well, no, I can't put them in the deal. So then you sort of know that they're trying to take your player and then go do another deal. So as you get to know the personalities, you know, sincere offers, you know, people that are just trying to rob you, and they're, you know, when the phone would ring, I'd be meeting my staff and I'd say, uh-oh, so-and-so's on the phone. Let's see what this is. Yeah, and you know right away, and you get off the phone, you go, you believe what he asked for? And I'd say it out there. So you knew certain people, it was going to be an outlandish. And then you knew certain people was going to be sincere and this is what it is. And, you know, some people would even say, look, I'm going to email it to you. Here how it is. Here's how it works. Here we see it working for you. But you get to know the personalities really well.
Well, how much hustling was you doing, though? How much?
Trust me, I was hustling, and you know, and I was thinking about this today before coming on with you guys. I would try to like say, would you trade so-and-so? They go, no. What if I put a first in it? No. How about two firsts? How about three firsts? And how about four firsts? And my staff is behind me go, we can't give up four firsts. I said, no, I'm just trying to see what it would take. Would they bend or would they just, there's nothing they could do. So I was never going to offer the four firsts, but I was just trying to get to a point where they say, we'll think about it.
Did anybody ever just give you their best offer right off the bat, like in December? Like, this is the best we can do for that guy.
There were some, I guess, go back to the Brooklyn. We were trading, I think, Joe Smith to the Lakers. Mm-hmm. Sasha Vucevic was part of it. And Joe Johnson, I mean, Joe Smith was coming in. We were sending back Terrence Williams and some other pieces that Mitch needed. And I said, okay, and we liked it. And then we were going to do it that day, the next day, agree on it. And I got a call out of the blue from another team and said, we'll take Terrence. Would you do Terrence Williams for a first? And I said, oh, okay. It's because, Lakers really didn't want Terrence Williams. So I said, okay, I'll pull Terrence Williams out. That deal still works. And I went to Houston and said, hey, you take Terrence Williams. So I ended up getting another first out of it. So there is an art to doing it. And at the end of the day, right before you agree, you meet your staff and you say, are we crazy? Is this the right deal?
Yeah.
Does this make sense for us? Even when I go back to the Boston Brooklyn deal, I had everybody, I said, look, does this make sense? Owners represented everybody, are we doing the right thing? And we looked at it. We had a plan. We were going to spend and those picks were going to be low. We were going to keep spending and it didn't matter. So I said, well, let me show you what the numbers are going to be before we agree. And everybody signed off on it. But at the end of the day, when you do it, you never feel 100% confident because you're dealing with human beings and you never know changing cities, how they're going to adapt to the coming in, especially midseason coming to a locker room.
Yeah. There's so many people in any team that have to be involved in this. How did you kind of divide the labor up? You've got an assistant GM, you got a cap guy, you've got a cap team now. So how would you kind of say, all right, you handle this part of it, you handle this part of it, and we'll reconvene in 2 days or 3 days or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of time, and I was trained by Donnie Wall. So even though I was assistant coach, I watched how he did it. So a lot of the numbers I would do myself before I would, propose a deal. And then I would give it to the cap guy. I run the numbers. I think it works. Make sure everything works. Make sure the picks are all. And so they would do that. And then sometimes I would not get involved in the conversation on the trade. Like I'd tell somebody, hey, you call so-and-so and see if they will do this. And then I'll let somebody else with the assistant GM run with it for a while until it gets to the point where, okay, I think we have a deal. And then I'll get on the phone and say, okay, I know that our guys have been talking. Are you on board with this? And they say, okay, yeah. So it depends on relationships too. Sometimes a assistant GM may have a better relationship with another assistant GM or the actual GM. And so you let them run with it till it has to be signed off on. And then I always allowed my staff, anybody can present anything to me. I wanted everybody trying to figure out deals, try to make deals. So I want everybody to learn how to do deals. So I let everybody try to figure them out. But it was always fun for me. And I still do it to this day in my head. I'll look at numbers and look at them and say, I think that works. So when you hear all these rumors, I go, oh, they must be doing this because that guy's salary works here and they got to add this to make it work or there's no way that it works. So I'm always, I don't watch a game and look at it for the X's and O's. I'm looking at it sometimes for trade value, why this guy didn't play. Are they trading them? So it's hard to watch games because I'm not watching it to say, oh, that was entertaining. Yeah. It's more like, your mind never shuts off.
So you know how in like, for instance, in the NFL, if Bill Belichick comes calling, you like, this dude's pulling something, right? like some GMs are just good, right? Some people are good at talent evaluation, et cetera, right? Who are some GMs in the league today who you feel like are like that? If they're calling, they're so good at what they do, it makes you a little bit insecure about what you're giving up or what you may be losing.
Well, Danny Ainge was one when he was in Boston, you always were wondering what Danny had because if he proposed something, there's got to be something, behind it. And he got the best of a lot of us. Sam Presti there's always something with Sam, you know, because he'll present it in a way and you get on the phone and go, all right, Sam said he would do this. I don't know why he would do it. Let's think about this for a minute. So I think Sam and Danny, obviously, you know, his reputation precedes him and, you know, what he was able to do in Boston. But those are two that come off the top right of my head that they're very good. And Sam is just, it's Sam's presentation that sometimes throws you off because it's almost like he's just, you know, I'm not sure if I'll do this, but would you do this? you know, I got to still talk to my guy. I'm not sure, but he's very good.
This is the like the Ocean's 11 part of it.
Right, right. Yeah, right.
I was thinking, if I remember correctly, didn't you do the Mutombo deal? And then they went to the finals, right? That was a deadline deal, right?
Yeah.
And that's a deal that Larry wanted to do from, I think we were number one in the East, playing great in November, and Larry's like, we need Mutombo. I'm like, Larry, we're rolling here. We're like, at that point, lost like three games, and he's like, yeah, but he can help us. And, you know, and then we got in December, every day he kept the Mutombo. And I started talking to Atlanta, Pete Babcock, and if we can get it done, something done. We talked, you know, probably November, December, January, we were talking a little more. Then when we got into February, I think we were number one in the East. The All-Star game was in D.C., and right. Theo and, Rapp broke his wrist.
That was when the East team had that incredible comeback.
Yeah. Yeah.
In the fourth quarter, and it was Allen and Steph offensively, and at the other end, Mutombo blocking Robert. Everything. Yeah. And was that a catalyst? Did Larry say, we've got to make this deal now? Did he go nuts after that game?
Yeah, after the game, I saw Larry, and he looked at me and goes, I know. Because my big thing, too, at that point, Theo had surgery. He was going to have surgery, and he was going to be out 6 weeks, maybe 8 weeks. And I didn't know when he was going to return. And you never know how many times a chance to go to the finals come about. And so that's when I decided, all right, we've got to make this. And I pushed and pushed. And I felt bad because Theo had built his dream home here. The day he had surgery, he closed on the house and we traded him.
Oh, that must have been a fun phone call.
Oh, man. Ouch.
But wow. I got Mutombo to buy the house.
Oh, did you really? How about that?
It was a built house, brand new. So
right.
Theo got he got $1 million bonus because he made the All-Star game. Also, that was one of those things I put in there. Said, right, you know, at that point, yeah, All-Star game. Yeah, I'll put that in.
Yeah, right.
I was curious because that was pretty early in your GM career. I think it might have been second season, but I'm wondering what's your moment where you were like, "Yo, I'm nice." You know, you put your feet up, you pull out a cigar, like they can't see me out here.
you never do that because I think at the end,
come on, Billy, you gotta do it.
If you win a championship, then you say, "Yeah, you know," but you never because you always feel like. You know, did you give up too much? You know, is it going to work? Because you never know if it's going to work. Like, ironically, we made that Mutombo trade. If you look at our record from that date until the finals, we were a 500 team record-wise.
And the rest of that year?
Yeah, the rest of that year. Because it's so hard when you make deals mid-season just to get the chemistry and get guys understanding because they got to come in, learn the playbook, learn how to play with guys. And so that's what was my worry that year. Was it going to work? Cause we gave up Tony Kukoc and Nazi Muhammad. And so they were, you know, Nazi gave us depth and Tony gave us versatility and experience. So, and I knew we were getting future Hall of Famer, but you weren't sure if it was going to work.
That's so the finals. I don't care what anybody say. You went to the finals and took a game off the Lakers with Kobe and Shaq. That might as well be a trophy.
Yeah.
But you play for the trophy. So that was the problem. You play for the trophy.
How unrealistic are players around the trade deadline? Because you know your star player, whoever it is, wants to get his friend in here. We can go get Kobe. Go get Kobe. How do you kind of go, whoa, big fella, there's stuff we can do and stuff we can't.
That was the greatest thing of having Allen Iverson on your team because he never once said, go get me this guy, do this. You got to trade for this guy. He believed in himself. that he, you know, no matter what he's played.
Put with, anybody out here with me. Yeah.
He could win. So he wasn't like, you got to go get me this. You got to go get me that. Yeah. You know, after we make a deal, he'd be like, that's a good move or something like that. But he was never one to go get this guy. You know, there were other players that would say, you know, got to try to get this guy, that guy. But I was always leery during trade deadline. If I walked into the gym, I made sure I wasn't on the cell phone for practice because it made guys comfortable. If I was taking a call, I would
let see, it go. That's why I would do it. I would be on there and just make a dude shook. Like,
you'd be loud talking to Marcus. Like, yeah, I'll make that deal.
I'm talking to my mama, but I'm over there like, yeah. I don't like him anyway. So,
yeah, because even if, you know, like if I was, if I try not to travel with the team during the, like a week before the trade deadline, just I didn't want them always looking at me because you still have to try to win games. And so I tried not to. And sometimes I would have conversations with guys if their names were out there. I would, Brooke Lopez, you know, his name was out there with the Dwight Howard. And I would talk to Brooke. I said, Brooke, trust me. I've talked to your agent. I'm talking to them. And I'm going to talk to you. All those rumors you hear, they're just rumors. I said, if there's something that is close and there's a deal going to happen, I will talk to you first. Nothing will happen without me talking to you. So don't, as much as you can, try not to let it affect you because right now, and I said to him, I said, the only guy, I said, this is no disrespect, Brooke, but you know, I would trade you for Dwight Howard because I think Dwight at this point is further along in your career. I'm not trading you for anybody else. So any other rumors, don't worry about it. And I don't think this is going to happen with Dwight Howard, but I want you to hear from me. If a deal's going to happen, you will hear, your phone will ring and it'll be me on the phone.
Yeah. Conversely, you had some deals, and like you said, you were not shy about putting multi-team deals together. Obviously, the one that everybody remembers is the Matt Geiger screwing up the Iverson deal. What is that like when the names are out there and the deal's basically done, and then you have to kind of walk it back, and they have to come back into your locker room?
Yeah, well, fortunately, that one, all the pieces didn't get out because, you know, the players I was talking about, but I think it ended up being like 22 players, five teams, and Geiger knew that, you know, it voted with his trade kicker, and I just explained to him, and Pat Krejci went and met with Allen, said, Allen, I think they're going to, if you don't clean up, they may trade you. They're close to a deal.
Yeah,
And the effect, Matt came back and had a bad knee and didn't play much for the year. Allen came back and was MVP. So, And then, you know, Stephen Hunter, I traded him to Oklahoma City and he failed the physical. We tried, and we came back. And I just was honest with him. I said, Stephen, unfortunately, it didn't work. I thought that'd be a better situation for you. So, but you're back here and I want you to be a pro. I said, this is part of the business. And yeah. I told him I was trading you because I think that was going to give you a better opportunity to play there. It didn't. And now you can earn more minutes here. And he came back and he played well for us. I find that you just got to be honest with guys. I mean, I had it happen with Derek Coleman and Clarence Weatherspoon. And my first deal got voided. And first team meeting, I addressed it and said, yep, we tried to trade you. It didn't work. You guys have been in the league long enough. It's a business. But we got a job to do now. You're here. You're part of our team. And we got to go to work.
Can you fast forward maybe if you picked up your career and started in 2015 in the age of like social media and all, how much different do you think it would be? Like you were telling Brooke, I'm going to call you if it happens. Do you even get that luxury anymore? Do teams get the luxury to make a phone call before it's on Twitter?
Yeah, because I think usually it gets on Twitter because you call the agent, let them know you made the deal. And then the agent calls a report and tell them this is the deal they're doing. You know, when they do the trade call, they ask, you know, when do you want to announce it? And you say, give me an hour. And then I usually call right away and tell them, hey, this is, you know, the deal that we've traded you. But you ask, you know, for an hour, sometimes 2 hours. So I try to call them right away before it even gets to the agent to let them know, the player know directly. I mean, one time I called the player and it wasn't during the deadline and his wife answered the phone and she goes, have we been traded? And I says, is he there? We've been traded. I tried three times and finally said, yeah, you have.
Wow.
And that's the hard part.
Yeah,
that you're not just trading a player, you're trading a family. I mean, kids could be in school and have buddies and play on the team. And so when you make these trades, it's not just trading you know, player for player, it's sometimes it's you're moving a family, and it could be a 5-year-old or 10-year-old that all of a sudden now they got to move to a new city. And it's, so I try to be very careful with that, hoping that it doesn't get out, because if it's rumor and the kids of age, you know, people at school, especially now with social media, your dad's being traded, you know, kids can be cruel. They don't know they are, but they can be. So, and that's the hard part is you get to know these people, especially if they've been with you for a long time.
Well, how do you think it happens then that players are finding out on social more than I remember Robert Covington said he found out on social that he got traded to Minnesota. Like, how does that happen more, you think?
Yeah, I don't know. To me, the first thing my office has as part of, you said, who has jobs? My assistant used to have their numbers ready. And as soon as I got off the trade call, she'd have them on the phone for me. So from the time we agreed and the league said, okay, deal's done, I'm on the phone within 2 minutes, because I always wanted to hear from me before it got out social. So I think it's, you know, the only way it gets out is somebody in the office is texting a reporter or an agent, because the league's not going to put it out there if you agree to a time. So the only way it's getting out is somebody in your office or one of the offices are putting it out there. What I always tried to do, the people that were involved in the deal, I always had them in the room on the Zoom call, and I had my PR person in there on the Zoom call so that I know, okay, the only people knew on this end was here. So
yeah,
if it got out, it's coming from the other side.
Did you ever feel tempted to do a mole hunt?
Oh yeah, no, I have. Trust me, I have done that. I didn't do it when I was in the early part of my career, but yeah, I have done that, because I just don't think people realize how much it affects the families more than the players can handle it. It's the families. And when people are just putting people's stuff out there for that person's benefit, not for the player and their family's benefit, that's where, that's where you, as an organization, you lose trust and you lose that culture, because, you know, players will talk about how they were treated from that organization.
Yeah. Was there, I wondered about when you sent Garnett back to Minnesota, and that was a big emotional deal for a lot of different reasons.
Yeah.
And just how was that any different because it was KG, because you were sending him back to Minnesota? And, you know, was that something that, do you ever feel good about a deal when you say, okay, I know this guy wanted to finish his career in this place and I was able to get him there?
That one I felt really good about, because KG and I talked a lot leading up to the deadline. We talked for a couple of weeks because he first didn't want to go back there, and we talked about it. And I just said, I think it's a good place. I think Flip wants you. I think, you know, it's great to go back and finish where you started. So he and I spent a lot of time talking about it. And then once we were able to get it done, it almost didn't happen, because we needed him to sign a trade kicker in there. So he needed to sign this waiver and had to find him. You know, like, he was in Malibu at the time, because I think we were in LA, and he was in Malibu, and he didn't know how to work the fax machine in his house. And so his wife had to get home in time to get, I think we got it to the league like at 2:56.
That was a late one. That was right before the deadline. Yeah.
Because that was the last thing we needed, or the deal wasn't going to go through. So it was like 2:56. We got that to the league.
Jeez, that's hilarious.
Are you struggling to close deals? B2B selling is tougher than ever, and that's why I want to tell you about LinkedIn Sales Navigator. LinkedIn Sales Navigator is a sales intelligence platform that helps professionals effectively prospect and engage high-value customers, drive higher revenue, and increase sales performance. Sales Navigator helps you target the right buyers, surface key signals, and show you hidden allies so that you can find those buyers that are most likely to convert. Fueled by LinkedIn's 1 billion member platform, Sales Navigator gives you up-to-date, first-party data, enabling you to unlock conversations with the people that matter. Right now, you can try LinkedIn Sales Navigator and get a 60-day free trial at linkedin.com/NBAshow23. That's linkedin.com/NBAshow23 for a 60-day free trial. Let LinkedIn Sales Navigator help you sell like a superstar today. Just go to linkedin.com/NBAshow23 and get started.
you, some of these guys, you know, obviously develop these relationships with. I know Bob Myers always talks about, like, that's the part, like, that people don't know, the relationships with the player. How do you do that? How do you build a relationship with your player, especially when they're there for 4 or 5 years, and then just become like a mob figure in Axum? Right? Like, how do you juggle these two kind of existences where you got to be a businessman and make the move, but also I know your kids, right? Like, so you're my guy.
Yeah. Well, fortunately, I think if you have a good relationship with them, it will last through that. Now, unless it, you know, if it got soured in, but a lot of the guys that either I traded or whatever, I remain friendly with them. Some of these guys I still talk to this day. And then there's some that just, you know, despise me and I didn't have a chance to talk to him. But the ones that I had a strong relationship, strong bond with beforehand, when it happens, you know, you just have to be honest and you try to explain to them, this is probably going to be a better situation for you while we're doing it anyway. And then when you explain it to them, they really wanted you this side, they see you fitting in. And you give them, when you get there, I know so-and-so, this person, that person, talk to them. They can help you. And we talked to them. If there's anything we can do to make the transition, I know your family's here. We can help you here. We'll do that. So I was always, you know, I've been over backwards to try to make it as easy as. So sometimes we would do it. A couple of teams, like when we did the Theo Ratliff, Aaron McKee, Detroit and I split a plane so that, you know, Aaron and them flew in and then we flew Jerry Stackhouse back on the plane. So you try to make it as easy as possible for guys. And, you know, if you can do that where there's a plane involved, it makes it easy.
I always wonder who handles the cost of moving a house. Like, you got somebody, they got to sell their house. Everything's got to go out of the house to the new house. Does the team acquiring the player handle that, or the team trading the player?
Yeah, the team acquiring, you're responsible for the move. You're responsible for putting them up in housing or paying their. I think it's a choice. You can pay their new housing where they come, or you can pay their old mortgage. They get to choose. But yeah, I mean, so that's the whole big thing that you do is you try to do everything you can with the move and housing. And you try, when they come in, you just want them to be as comfortable as possible so they can play basketball.
Is it harder with the guys you're closer with because you're close with them, or is it easier because you have the relationship and you can kind of manage those elements? It seems like it would feel like when, you know, you get a whooping and your parents would be like, this is harder on me than it is on you. Is that how you feel?
It's never easy when you got to make that phone call. All my years of making trades, there's only one player I never had the conversation with. He never picked up the phone, never returned the call. Otherwise, I talked to every player when I traded him. And then there was a lot, as DA would attest, there were a lot of trades.
So we talked about some of the trades that maybe were, you know, the coach was pushing for it or ownership was pushing for a big splash. Is there a trade or two that you pushed for that wound up being, wow, that was a home run? And then another one that where you go, I really kicked that one. I really messed up on that one.
Yeah, I mean, there are some deals. You know, I mean, I go back and look at the Brooklyn. You always go back to trade with Boston. You try to say, yeah, should have took this back, should not have put that in. And, you know, there was parts that I pushed for. There was parts that ownership pushed for. And I said I should have pushed back and a little bit on that. That's the one that I, to this day, you go back and analyze it more. But there has been so many of them. I don't think ownership ever made me do a deal that I didn't want to do a deal. There were times I was doing deals to get under the tax. But it was never a guy I wanted to get rid of that I was like, there was a deal in the Tony Kukoc deal. You know, Bruce Bowen had to be part of the deal to make the numbers work. I didn't want to put him in. I had no other way to do it. I thought they weren't going to keep him there and cut him or re-sign him. And Miami claimed him off waivers and he went to Miami, played well, then ended up in San Antonio. But that was a part of the deal I did not want to, but I couldn't figure out a way not to put him in the deal to make it work. And that's probably the one that really stands out for me the most, because Larry and I saw something in him and he went on to have a great career, but you know, he was the number that made the deal work, and it just killed me. And I knew that Chicago probably wasn't keeping him, and I can get him back, but Miami claimed him, and yeah, the rest was history.
Yeah. How do I put this delicately? How much of a pain in the ass are we in the media at trade deadline time?
You are, but it's part of your job. but I understood that was part of the job. Yeah. As much frustrated I would get, I understood that, you know, as much as I had a job to do to try to make a deal, you guys had a job to do to try to report on the deals. And afterwards you look back and you say, oh, I knew what you were doing. I knew you had to do your job, but it's frustrating. And, you know, I think I told you this, I told the beat writers, I said, look, I'll never lie to you. And so if I can't answer, then that gives you your answer right there.
Exactly.
Man, I love when people don't lie to you. Like, that never lie. I love that. But, man, more people need that integrity because you get a lot of lies. I would lie to the media, though, for sure, in a heartbeat. No question.
You'd lie to them straight up. You'd lie to them.
If I were you, Billy, I'm lying.
No, you just say, I can't answer that. And they know what you're saying by saying, I can't answer it.
Yeah.
Or if you say, I'm not doing that deal, then they know, okay.
I would, you know, I know I get frustrated at this time of year because there are people, you know, most people will do that, right? They'll say, I just can't talk about my team, which is fine. I get that. But you're dealing with other people that are just throwing stuff out there that aren't even like they are acting like it's a source story when it's not, you know, and it's just something that's what's frustrating because now and I'm sure you had to do the same thing. You got to go chase something that you know isn't true. And I just wonder if there's collateral damage. Like now all of a sudden I got to call this guy up and say, whatever you saw on TV or you heard on or you read on the internet, that's not true. Like, that's
and that's the problem. Sometimes I would go on record. I would address it and say, what was reported, we're not doing it, and it's not even close to being a deal. And you hate to do that to somebody, but you just got to do it, you know, because you don't want the players to feel, especially if somebody's really way off base. If somebody's legitimate, they're close, you don't do it. But if somebody's way off base and they're consistently off base, I have no I would have no problem, and I have not had a problem calling them out. And I'd call them out by name. I wouldn't call them out by name. I'd call
their organization.
Their organization out.
Man, that's cold-blooded. What about the person who worked for the organization who's doing well? No, we need you to blast DA. Like, David, say him by... You know, Billy, it's I guess I'm allowed to ask you this because it's February, but there's a lot of talk now, mostly in the NFL, about diversity in front offices and coaching staffs. As someone who's been in it, as someone who has so much experience in it, what do you propose as some solutions to help this process? Instead of, you know, we can talk about how the numbers look all day long and we know what they are, but what are some things that after being inside and from the inside you think would help diversify front offices?
Well, I think you got to figure out how to get everybody in the room. You've got to get the people, the owners, unfortunately the owners hire who they know. And if they don't know a lot of people or who and the business dealings with, you know, African-Americans or minorities, they're not going to hire them. So I think you've got to get them in a position. They generally are dealing with other head coaches, other owners. Mm-hmm. And so until you get them in the same room where they get associated and acquainted with them, it's not going to change. You can have the Rooney Rule, which I think is a foolish rule, because when you say you have a Rooney Rule, you're saying you have a problem already. I think you've got to figure out a way how to get, you know, minorities in the same room of the decision makers so they get to know them and not, it should not be the TV commentators saying, well, Eric Bieniemy, he should be getting a head job or this guy. You've got to get because the owners, some of them aren't even watching those games, but you've got to just get them in a room where they can be acquainted. Tomlin would have never got the job in Pittsburgh, but he went in there, got in the room, and they're like, wow, this guy is very impressive. And so before the interview process, I think they got to figure out a way, like the owners meeting, have the coaches there too, and have a social night where they bring all the coaching staffs, where they spend time and talking and have cocktails so they get to know them and these guys, I like that guy.
Yeah, but I also think the commissioners play a big role. I mean, I believe this to this day that David Stern simply, not that he ordered it, but he certainly made it clear that he wanted diversity in front offices. Like, he wanted coaches to get hired. He wanted GMs to get opportunities. And he may not say hire this specific person, but he would certainly say, y'all have never had a minority, whatever. You need to, that needs to change. And I do think that pressure from the commissioner's office certainly helps in this regard.
Yeah, no, it definitely does. And I think David also would make recommendations. He'd say, you need to talk to X, Y, and Z on this team or this guy. You know, he's impressive. Yeah. I've met him. And so you've got to, you know, just anything, just talk to him before you make a decision. I think you'd be impressed by him. And owners would trust David in that regard. And I think Adam is doing the same thing. And I think that's where, like you said, Roger Goodell, I don't know how much he puts himself in a position to know a lot of these people. But if he does, he could easily say, hey, when you get a chance, you should read up on this gentleman. This gentleman is really good, has a chance, because owners, they want to win. And they're going to hire who they think they can win, because he's going to make them money. They're not going to say, I'm not hiring that guy and I'll keep losing. They want to win.
Yeah, right. Well, BK, as always, man, I'm smarter after talking to you than before, man. I really appreciate your time, yeah, man.
Absolutely. You're the best.
Please stay safe out there, and safe travels. Maybe. Well, you going to be in Cleveland? Hopefully we'll see you in Cleveland.
No.
Good for you.
That note was quick. I like that. Was quick. Absolutely was quick. Not. No Cleveland for you, buddy.
I'm not mad at you, Billy, man. Yeah. Stay safe, man. Appreciate you.
Take care, guys.
All right. Man, thank all of you for listening to this fine, fine American podcast. You can hear us on Google Play, Spotify, Apple, iTunes, everywhere. You hear this American-made broadcast. Marcus, if the folks leave less than 5 stars on that review, what do they need to do?
They need to get traded to Sacramento. Exactly. Get out of here. Go to the dungeon.
You haters. Later.
Bye.